Welcome to the photo show. Yes, 3 weeks in a row. That's more than we've achieved in the last 4 years in a row. I'll take that. It's good enough. I'm fine. I've got the week. I'm Ewan Rankin. I'm a Birmingham-based photographer, and I've got a few minutes to take you through the news of the week, the gear of the week, and your questions. And that's the format of the show. 5 stories of each, and then 3 questions from you guys at the end. If you'd like to send us a question, we always, always need questions. So please, please, please do it. Send it to britishtechnetwork@gmail.com or britishtechnews@gmail.com, and we'll get it posted up, and we'll answer your question for you if we possibly can. If not, we'll know someone who can. Don't worry. And also, we could do with some reviews as well. Now we're back on. iTunes has had a few little blips and we've gone up. But if you could stick us some reviews in iTunes, that would make a world of difference. We will read out every review that we get, I promise. Good or bad. We've had some bad ones over the years. But some of them have been rectified. Some of them haven't. But send us a review and we'll read your review out. And thanks very much for taking the time, because that makes a massive difference to us in iTunes as well as. So let's get started. Without further ado, the news. First story up. It's an interesting one. A very interesting one. That beeping in the background was my GoPro. I've had it on a test all morning, so I'll be talking about the GoPro later on in the show. The first one is a chap who has decided, Matteo, and I can't say his surname, I don't want to insult him by getting it wrong. He founded Digital Move Studio in 1997, and they specialise in aerial and underwater photography. And he's done a project whereby using a flash out in a bright desert area, he shot ejecting cartridges from guns. I don't know if it's for a project for advertising or what, but he's done a great job of trying to capture them and freeze them in motion, allegedly. That one's particularly good from the side. The ones at 45 degrees, he's got a lot of motion blur on them, but the ones from the side are very good. The reason I thought this was quite interesting, thanks to Ian as well, who's picked this story, the reason I think this is interesting is this shows a really good point for amateurs, that if you want to shoot at a very high speed or something that's at very high speed, say a train or a car that's coming towards you, that kind of stuff, there's nothing worse than trying to track something that's moving across your line of vision. So if you see this shot here, the first cartridge is coming out and it's going across the line of vision that Matteo's got looking to his subject. As soon as you go to the side, you can see that that clearly freezes it an awful lot better. At 1/4,000th of a second, including the flash that he's got on, I'd be surprised if that one there wasn't an awful lot slower than it currently is. But it's a good project. I don't know why he's done it. I couldn't find that out. There's vague details about him shooting it, and there's a little video on how he's gone about shooting it. Whether he's triggered these manually or not, I don't know, but you can get noise triggers so that when the gun goes off, it'll automatically trigger the flash and the camera. But it's an interesting result, but I thought that was a good story, because mostly, if things are travelling towards you, then you're more likely to catch them without motion blur than you are if they're coming across you. Yep, so position yourself, you know, if you're catching a train or a bird that's flying or something like that, the bird flying towards you is going to be far stiller than the bird that's flying across you. Just an interesting one. There we go. The next one is the story of the week. I have had no end of fun with this. Me and Ian have been swapping notes on this all morning. It's absolutely fantastic. This is an online photo coach. And it's called Keegan, and it's named after an American photographer who lives in Paris. And a lot of the phrases are his phraseology about how he critiques photographs, and they've used them on this algorithm. Essentially, what you do is you send your picture, you upload your picture to Keegan, and Keegan will analyze your photo and tell you if it's any good or not. So I thought, well, this is just a basic algorithm. It's going to really screw up. But there's a couple of interesting examples where he's used it. So this one is a picture of the Dalai Lama meeting President Obama. And it's quite interesting because actually it's done a good job of appraising the image. It's a reportage image, so you're not going to get 100% exposure on it. It's not going to be perfect. The lighting's not going to be ideal. And you're not going to pick your background necessarily, because this is only a brief embrace and you want to capture the moment. It says, I'm not sure about your lighting. Also, what's going on in the background? Okay, image, you could improve your background, your lighting and your composition. There's nothing wrong with saying those, because they could, but you would have lost the moment, as I said. This deserves a 5.4 out of 10. Not bad. but I'm sure you can do better. Hashtag bleak. Bit harsh, but okay. So what the testers did was they thought, well, let's put something in that we know is good. So they stuck in a photo from Ansel Adams, and it said, I love the composition, nice framing, pleasant lighting. Great, this image is really good. Without a doubt, it's 8.1 out of 10. This is much better already, hashtag composition. So that's quite interesting that it's got a reportage image and downgraded it. It's got an Ansel Adams picture and upgraded it. That's awesome. So I thought I'll stick some of mine in. This is Paul Klusker. He's my osteopath. And I shot some pictures for him in my studio. And I've already got more than Ansel Adams has. your subject looks right at home and all cozy in your composition. Pleasant lighting. Good. Wonderful portrait. Thank you. Congrats. You get a 9.1 and I got a gold ribbon as well. An impressive start. You're a pro, right? Thanks, man. Appreciate that. So I put another one of a girl called Cody that I shot a few years ago. Love the details and blur adds a nice touch. Wow, this is intriguing. Well-placed subject. Capture the light. 9.1 out of 10. So I'm doing very well. I got the framing ribbon with that one as well, which I was really chuffed about. So that's not bad. After 10 pictures, I'm going to evaluate your level. So I've started a bit high. I might end up going down if I'm not careful. Next one. Now, this is a picture that I shot of Cody that I wasn't overly happy with, but I cropped it to what I thought would be a decent picture. But there were certain nice qualities about the smile she had and that kind of stuff. Keegan apparently loves it. Keegan said, just enough blur. I like the well-placed subject. It's 9.5 out of 10. You deserve it, champ. Well done. So I'm doing okay at this point. Very happy. And I get to put this one in the Hall of Fame, and I'm in the Hall of Fame. But then I put another photo in that I didn't like very much, and Keegan thought it was a 10. Embrace the blur. The light's hitting your subject just right. Yes, such a great composition. 10 out of 10, epic. I've got a platinum ribbon and I'm on page one of the Hall of Fame with that one. So I thought I'd stop there. That'll be it. I won't do these head images because then it's only going to go downhill after that. But what I did was persist with a few more technical challenges. So the shot I'm about to show you now, this shot was, it's a guy who's cutting a rail using a skill saw, and the sparks are flying everywhere. I get absolutely showered in sparks, and the lens had a tiny bit of molten metal on it at the end of it. Well, the lens cover did, the UV filter. So I always use UV filters. But the customer absolutely adores this image. It's up on their wall in their office, and they think it's fantastic. And Keegan said, I'm iffy about the background, although, okay, the background's not brilliant, and I'm not sold on the composition. I've got to take issue with that. 4.9 out of 10. So I then put a few more industrial images, and it doesn't like industrial images. If you haven't got a person there, if it's not a portrait or it's not a landscape, you tend to get quite a low score. So a lot of the crap that I shoot for a living, which is crap, I do say that's not a problem, it's industrial rubbish, then that doesn't get very well scored. And then I had a thought, and this is where it gets really fun. Do you remember Ms. Schneiderman last week, who won the award for the best newcomer photographer for a thing on North Wales? Well, I thought they were crap images myself, but I thought, I wonder what Keegan thinks of them. So I shoved them through. This is the one of the bus stop that I showed you. Subject's really starting to pop, but your colours are flat. Overall, this picture is just okay, 6.2. And I agree with that, but it's a picture of a bus stop, so you know, steady on. This one, the house with the Christmas lights up, that light is not working. And this is a bad composition. It's something I guess you could do better. Try improving your lighting composition and your blur. This is at most 2.6. Keegan does seem to love blur. If you stick blur in an image, then you're well away. Otherwise, I'm afraid you're not. And that's the doorbell, so I'll be back in a moment. And then the next one is the very badly underexposed picture of the girl. And again, it's picked that up. So I'm actually starting bleak, bad colours. I'm starting to think this is not too bad at all. But then it comes off. The wheels fall off. So I showed it the one of the hills in the background with the dimly lit houses. And it says you need to invest in some studio lighting. Well, based on the fact that you're in the outside of a hill in middle of Wales, studio lighting is not going to do you any good. 3.6, so that's not good. This is the other one of those that were done. And I didn't dislike this one particularly, but it's got 7.7 and it says, The subject looks cozy in their composition within there. There's enough blur, loves blur, Keegan loves blur. But then all I did was stick it through Photoshop and adjust it for levels so that colours popped a bit more, the whites were white and the blacks were black. And all of a sudden, I'm getting a framing ribbon for it. And a score of 8.1. So there's definitely something going on with Keegan that's really, really good. Again, though, there was a bit of a fudge factor with one of the images. Because I put in a shot that I took of the Milky Way at Long Mynd. And Keegan said, nice timing. Well, based on the fact I got all friggin' night to shoot it, I think nice timing is probably not the right phrase to use. Hashtag composition. So I've got a decent composition there. I made page one. Look, there's me on the left. I was quite impressed with it, I have to say. If you're an amateur, I think you'd really get something from this. It said I was a pro right at the start when I was putting in portraits. By the time I put in a few industrial images, he said I was an enthusiast. So maybe some of you are writing with some hate mail that says that you never have been anything else, mate. But there we go. If you're an amateur, though, I think this is really, really good. You can get it in the show notes, but it's Keegan, K-E-E-G-A-N, dot regained, R-E-G-A-I-N-D, dot I-O. And if you go there and put your images in, it'll give you an appraisal of your images. And I think amateurs would get an awful lot from this, because it does give you some pointers, and it does say what's wrong with your image. And it actually seems fairly accurate. The one thing I will say, though, is if you go and look at the page of the classic images, the Hall of Fame images, every single one of them is well-adjusted for colour and well-adjusted for levels and looks very stock photography. So it does seem to analyse, the algorithm seems to have been done against stock photography libraries, I would suggest. It is very stocky, which isn't always good if you get into the artistic element anyway. So, but there you go. I thought that was an interesting. I think that's story of the week. I really enjoyed that. No bad at all. The slow-mo guys have captured some video at 120 frames a second. This is a firecracker going off underneath the water. And you can watch the video. The thing that's quite interesting about this, everyone's seen stuff, but if you look at the slow-mo stuff has been around for years, but if you look at the explosion lasted for 1/100th of a second at 24 frames a second. But what they've done is stretch that out to 50 seconds long at 120 frames per second. It is incredible to watch the thing come apart. And you get that cavitation effect where, you know, it kind of comes to a massive size and then it all of a sudden collapses back in on itself. Really good. Worth a watch if you get the chance to go over it and get it a petapixel. Good story. The next one's quite an interesting one. You go on holiday and you say to your dad, can I take the camera please, Dad? And he goes, yeah, sure, no problem. Have the camera, son. Away you go. And you go, I'll look after it, I promise. And then you pull over at McDonald's while you're in Vermont and you have a stranger come up to you and take a picture for you. And the stranger doesn't run off the camera. Don't worry about it. You take the picture of you and all your friends and you think that's going to be one for posterity. And then you get back in the car and you drive home. Then you pull out your GoPro, which has got some kind of drone thing that's going to fly along next to it and take some great footage. And it is great footage of the guys driving the car along the highway. And then when you get home, you realise you can't find your dad's camera. But the GoPro has captured the fact that you actually left it on your roof. So there you go. There is the GoPro footage of this young lad. The chap is on a Reddit poster. He's called T-Wop. And he went out with his friends. He did exactly what I've just described. And then he let this GoPro out the window. I don't know how they've done it. I mean, maybe it's on a stick or something, but it's very well shot. It doesn't look like it's on a stick, selfie stick. And it captures the moment, the exact moment, that Dad's camera slides off the roof and smashes on the floor of the roadway. Bad luck. The camera was worth over $1,000. And it doesn't say whether he's been let off grounded yet or not, but there you go. That was good. I've got to say, the thing that really impressed me about that story was there's a guy there holding a selfie stick, but you don't get that impression all the way through what they're shooting. It's like they've almost left something out the window, like there's a drone following them or something. But I thought it was an interesting story. I must remember that one for Ellis as well. If he ever borrows a camera, he's dead meat, though, if he pushes it off the top of the roof. That's good. Last news story, Hoya. We love Hoya. They look after us. If you do get a chance, please do support Hoya. I'm wearing the Mantec lenses. Now, the Hoya that do the glasses is not the Hoya that does the lenses that you put on your camera, UV filters. All of my stuff that I put on the front, all my circular polarizers, all Hoya. I've bought them for years. Different firm, though, effectively, from the Hoya that support us. But they've released a whole new line of neutral density filters that are supposed to prevent infrared contamination. They're basically saying that for the Solas range at $49 will stop any kind of contamination from an infrared viewpoint onto — that's my GoPro beeping again, I'll be talking about that in a second — of your image. They do anything from 46 millimeters to 82 millimeters, which is the broad brush of most of your lenses. They do 1 stops to 10 stops. In terms of price, the lower end ones, which are going to be probably the 46 mil ones, are $49, and the higher end ones are $151.90, allegedly. They only maintain neutral color balance, but the RR aspect prevents infrared contamination, which can present red noise or a difficulty correct color shift afterwards in post-production. So that should be dead interesting. And that's the end of the GoPro test that's just gone off in the background, which has done very well, actually. I've been very impressed with it. Price is pretty good on those. I mean, if you're talking about neutral density filters, you can spend an awful lot of money on neutral density filters. I've got a 1000 ND filter, which I think cost me £71. That's like a almost like a welder's mask kind of level. I used it for shooting the sun. It's not bad. It's not bad. We've had a chat with Hoya, and we've asked for a few of these for some tests. So hopefully they'll come through. Hopefully we can do some tests on them. We can post a review on the website. But there you go. That was the news. Time for the gear. If you remember, a couple of weeks ago, I said, if you can all have a fund, you all dib in a few dollars, I'll buy a GoPro 5 and I'll test it. Thanks to someone who did, they sent me $25 to start the fund off. I haven't used it for that. What I've done is put it towards the Mac Mini fund, but it's very kind of you. Thank you for sending that in. They also sent $25 for the Mac, £25 for the Mac Mini fund. So that's £50 towards the Mac Mini fund for the Skype wall for the other shows. And that's, I think we're only about £150 short now of having the last of the Mac Mini. So thanks to those people that have sent that in. You can send it in via Patreon, patreon.com/BritishTechNetwork, or through the PayPal account, which is at bageltechnews@gmail.com. So anyway, I thought, well, it's time to come and buy this thing and see what it's like. And I have bought, there we go, the GoPro Hero 5 Black. First impressions, I'm really, really impressed. Really impressed with it. It comes in a skeleton housing, as we said, and it isn't bad. But the only thing is that because it's got a rubberized edge to it so that you can grip onto it if you're out swimming or holding it manually to shoot, it doesn't slide in the casing so easily. So you can get it a bit stuck sometimes. And if you do, when you push that in, if it gets slightly out of line, if it's near the end, you've got virtually nothing to hold onto to pull out. But I mean, that's kind of a bit of a picky quip. Simple things that I like: there's like a little rubber lug now in the slide-on thing that you pull up and down, and that stops you from tweaking that. I've had a couple of those fall out, so that's a really, really good addition for me, most definitely. The GoPro housing, the skeleton housing, is very simple and very small. I haven't worked out how much the price of these is to replace them, though, but I can see you're losing this. That's the only thing. And the other thing I can see is as well, because it's kind of like the GoPro is now in its own housing permanently as a waterproof housing, if this lens is going to get scratched, then it'd be interesting to see how much replacement versions of this are. It does look, though, if you look at the edge there, you can see that it does look like it comes off completely. So that's not too bad. I think that's really, really good. In terms of use of it, it sets up beautifully. You can connect it via Bluetooth to the Capture app or via wireless to the Capture app. And it sets up far easier than the other GoPros did with the old Capture application. In terms of battery life, well, that's what I've just been doing over there. I set it on a 2-second lapse, time lapse And the batteries are fairly small, so I did have hopes that it would be slightly better, but I didn't think it would be. It's shot nearly 2 hours of time lapse. Now, the other ones that I've got crap out after 40 minutes, even the really good GoPro batteries crap out after 40 minutes. So that's brilliant. They've really done something about the battery life on this, which has improved me no end. Screen on the back is beautifully clear, and it also is a touch screen, and it's a user control interface. It actually turned up with the default language being German. So I had to sit and try and work out how to change it and set up the capture app, because one of the problems is if it comes with a default language on it that's not yours, there's no way to change it on the camera. You have to change it through the capture app. So I'm sitting trying to pair my phone with crap German on this and what I can get out of the positioning that's on the diagrams on the internet. But I managed it in the end. It took me a bit longer than it should have done, but it's over there. Got all the features that you had in the other one, an awful lot. We did the specs a while ago, so I'm not going to go through those again. What's kind of nice is this is waterproof, and there's a charging point here. It takes USB-C as well, not micro USB, so it's a lot firmer connection and really, really good. I'm really chuffed with that. But I hope this is going to come out on the mic. When you undo this little door, there's like a suction, which proves that it really is waterproof. You ready? Here we go, see if I can do it. Did you hear that? That's probably great audio, isn't it? But it does, it goes like it's pulling it off. And the other thing you can do is you can take that door off. There you go. So if you've got it in a static situation where you want a continuous power for it, then you've got it right there. Why am I holding it to the microphone? Idiot. You've got it on a continuous charge there, and it's really, really good. There's a micro HDMI out as well, so you can do a direct feed. You can also position it on, I guess that's for the drone, the Karma thing. I'm dead impressed with it. I'm really impressed with it. If it was money no object, I would swap all of my old ones out and buy six of these quite happily. It's sturdy. It feels sturdy. It's heavy. It's got good battery life, and the picture quality is awesome. I've been really impressed with it. £349, it's £100 cheaper than I paid for the 4 Black. So that's a real positive. Well done, GoPro. Well done. Really, really like it. Good purchase. If you're rumming and ahhing over whether to get a GoPro or not, definitely. And £349, it's a great price and featureful. Absolutely featureful. Superb. Voigtlander have added some new lenses. What you can see here is a very outlandishly shaped one called the VM 50mm Helia lens. It's for M mount bodies, 5 elements in 3 groups, max aperture of f22, 10 blade iris for circular out of focus highlights and that kind of stuff, which is good. Non-click stop aperture ring. So that's a bad thing if you want to do stops. It's nice to hear it click. I don't see that as a real positive myself. It's 50 millimeters only. It's f3.5 at the low end. It's very narrow and very long, so I'm thinking that there might be a bit of vignetting on it, but maybe I'm wrong. But it's not bad. There is a 65 millimeter f2 macro lens for Sony E-mount, which is great. Minimum focus distance is 0.31 of a millimeter, which 0.3 of a meter, sorry. 10 elements in 8 groups, max aperture of f22, 10 blade iris again, and it'll be able to transmit EXIF data to the camera as well as trigger manual focus assistance such as automatic magnification and peaking as well. I'm not sure if these are auto or all manual. I think they're all manual, so that's interesting. And then the last one is the one that's there in the center, and that's the 58mm f1 Norton. This is for Nokia. It's unchanged from the original one that they had, but it offers a retro barrel design, in inverted commas, and it features a meter coupling prong that allows you to use it with older bodies. So if you remember, we had a question last year about a little prong that stuck out from a lens and what it actually did. So it was we suggested it was the manual aperture control. So this thing should work with far older cameras that work on the same system. Again, I think it's all manual if you want to have a go at using this. No word on price, and they say they're due in autumn. autumn, but they're not out yet. I think if you want this kind of thing, if you've got an older camera or you've got that older effect-looking camera, you might want it. Other than that, though, I'd be interested to see the price. If the price is keen, yeah, they might sell. But if the price isn't keen, I'm struggling to see the point. But maybe that's me. This is the EXO lens. I've only got one picture of it, and that looks like it's a fake mock-up. This is offered for people who've got iPhone 6, 6S, and 7. It doesn't say that they're offering it for iPhone 7 Plus at all, so I'm presuming it won't, because it's only a single lens for a start, so whether it switches between the two or not, I don't know. It adds to an existing lineup of Zeiss optics that the company pushes out, and it says that they're calling it a prime lens for artistic expression and non-technical social sharing. There's lots of nice things about how this thing is milled and how spherically adept it is and that kind of stuff. So it sounded like they were pushing a bit more towards the semi-pro market or people who were really, really into their iPhone photography. It's due out on the 7th of December. You can get it for 6, 6S, and you can get it for 6S Plus and 6 Plus and 7 only. It's $199. That's expensive. It's a big lens, and it's Zeiss optics allegedly, and it's great, but that's a big lens to carry around. It sticks out a fair old bit. You also can't put it in a case unless you buy their case as well as. You can also get a wide angle kit, which is coming in December, which is $249, and a macro zoom kit as well, which is coming with a Vario Proxar 40-80 macro zoom lens. It's got a variable focal length of 40-80mm optical, which is very interesting, and if you could tie that to the 7 with an optical stabilization, or an optical zoom as well, that would be really good for the 7 Plus, but I don't think it does. Turning the ring does not reduce the field of view. It acts like a focus ring, and it moves the plane of focus. Turning right allows you to capture subjects 3 to 5 centimeters away, and turning it right will go from 5 to 8 centimeters away at a maximum level. It's available for some other phones as well as in January, supposedly. The Prime kit is available, and the wide angle kit from the 7th of December. The Prime range is... but there's no price. Oh, I missed the last bit out. Anyway, I just thought it was interesting, but it seems pricey for something that's an add-on to your iPhone. I'm not sure I'd spend that kind of money on this thing. You have to buy their case as well if you want to use it, and it doesn't say how it attaches to your phone, whether it's just a clamp or whether it's screwed on somehow, or whether you've got to buy a frame. On the picture that they've put here, which I think is just a mock-up, I don't know. I want to watch that one with interest and see where it goes. That's the only picture I've got, and it's a pretty crap picture. That's the one that was on the story, and I can't find anything else anywhere. I'll keep an eye on that one. We'll report back when it comes out, and I'll see if we can get a review unit. I'm skeptical, but then I am. So, you know, I might not be the best judge. We'll have to see. Now, do you own a lens baby? I used to own a lens baby, and I lent it to a chap, and he's never given it me back. And I used to enjoy it. It was great, because it was one of those things, it was on a set of springs, and you put it on the lens, you dial it up, and then you just pull at various points or rotate, and you get different effects on the lens. You get like some smudging that would appear on the left-hand side, because you were just, you know, looking through a lot more glass on that point than the other points. Artistically, it was great. It was great fun, but it was £80. And because it was a manual focus lens at £80 that you could do some fun stuff with, it was well worth the money. Since then, Lens Baby have got more money, and they've come out with new versions. And they do an awful lot more than they used to, but they're still a bit of a one-trick pony as far as I'm concerned. And I'm not sure they're worth the price, because you're up to £250 now for them, which is I think it's too much. But they've released one. It's called the Trio 28, and it's three lenses on a frame. These three lenses rotate and give you a different effect, so you can do twist, velvet, or sweet. So twist gives you a large, sharp central area and then an out-of-focus swirl around it. And it says it's got swirling bokeh on the out-of-focus areas. We all know about Bocca, don't we? Velvet has a very sharp yet dreamy central. I don't see how that works, man. Sharp and dreamy, no. With delicate glow from edge to edge. It sounds like the other one, but with different spiel put on it. I did say another word there, nearly. The sweets setting creates a sharp central sweet spot of focus surrounded by gradually increasing blur. Which, again, sounds a little bit like the first one. I'll stand corrected when I've had a go with it. But at this point, it seems very samey. You've got the ability, I don't know if you can push this thing to change that, you know, so there's like a big pad there to the left of where the rotating lens is. And it's interesting if you could push that and then change the effects a little bit. That might be quite interesting. There's a picture here of it. It doesn't say which one that is. But it's a sharp center with a blurry outer edge, but that could be any three of the settings from those descriptions, as far as I see. Like I said, call me a cynic. Pricing, $279, available in Sony E-mount, Micro Four Thirds, and Fuji X at the moment. So if you're Canon and Nikon shooters, you're getting left out in the dark. Is it worth the money? That's going to cost you £250 at current exchange rates. And I've got to say no in my book, because nearly everything that you can do there, you can do in post-ed easily. You've only got to create a vignette a marching ant line around where you want sharp focus, and then feather it, and then make a duplicate layer, and then you can do what you like to that duplicate layer. If you want a vignette, you just add a multiply effect to it in Photoshop. If you want blurs, then all you do is put in a motion blur or a Gaussian blur, and you get the same kind of effect that you've got here. I wouldn't spend the money on that. I like messing around with stuff, don't get me wrong, but I wouldn't spend the money on that. It's not enough, nowhere near enough. Last one then is the Sony. It's a brand new offering from them. It's the RX 100 Mark V and the Sony 6500. The CyberShot, the RX 100 Mark V, is a 20 megapixel sensor. It's got a fixed 24 to 70 millimeter zoom at f1.8 to f2.8, which is not bad. I mean, if you look at what I shoot out on site with the stills camera, more often than not, I've got a 24 to 70 millimeter lens on it at f2.8. So that's kind of the thing I would be shooting out on site as a professional anyway. Added phase detection autofocus at 315 points of focus. That sounds great. Sony claimed that the f-speed is as fast as 0.05 of a second, 0.05 of a second, which is brilliant. That is really awesome. And if it's a little tiny compact camera you can swing around, superb. 24 frames per second at full resolution on burst mode, that's impressive. And autofocus as well, and auto exposure in that, up to 150 frames per second if you're shooting in JPEG and RAW. So that's doubly impressive. That means a big processor's going on the inside. The video's been improved. It's Ultra HD 4K at 5,000 by 2,008 pixels. It's 960 frames per second for slow motion modes if you look at the lower resolutions, but at 1080 you'll get 120 frames per second, which is very, very good. That's impressed me a great deal. It's got anti-distortion, full electronic shutter up to 1/32,000th of a second. So you're going to capture your cartridges in perfect sharpness there if you're ejecting them from your gun. 3-inch LCD at the back. It tilts up through 180 degrees so you can do your selfies. There we go. There's one of it peeking back over the top of the lens. Very, very good. Quite interested with that. And it's got a new underwater case that's available for it. You can take it down to 40 meters underwater. It's available in October, which is great, so that's now, and it's going to cost you, wait for it, £1,000. Well, it's $1,000, but that's going to be £1,000 by the time it hits here. Sony's stuff is overpriced at the moment. I don't know that this is overpriced, but what I think is it's not going to capture the imagination of people enough to want to spend a grand on it. The casing is extremely bland. There's no grip on it like there was with the stuff that, you know, the Olympus, when it they came out with those ultra compacts with interchangeable lenses and things like that. It looks Spartan. It is Spartan. It is fairly feature full, and I got to say the video and shooting stuff is absolutely excellent. But I'm just wondering whether they've got the price right on this one or not. I think they have in terms of features, but I don't know if they'll capture the imagination of people by the way it looks. That could be the downfall. We'll see. We'll see. They've also released, I haven't got a picture of this, an APS-C mirrorless camera called the A6500. Fastest autofocus with the highest number of autofocus points in its category. 24.2 megapixel sensor. The ISO range isn't bad. It's 100 to 51,200 and 11 frames per second in autofocus and exposure. 11 frames per second with continuous autofocus, which is pretty good. You can shoot, due to the expanded buffer size, 307 frames in a row without it falling over, which is pretty impressive. No price, no date on that one, though, unless it comes out in October with the other one. But the RX100, I think, is worth the money. But I don't think people will think it's worth the money. There's the issue. Oh, here we go. Sorry. The 6500 comes out in November for $1,400. And I've got to say, given the choice of the two, I'd be pulling out the RX100 because it's cheaper and it's got a lot better features. So there we go. That was the gear. So now it's time for your questions. If you've got a question, then send it to us at britishtechnetwork@gmail.com and we'll post it up and we'll answer the question for you and we'll send you on your way and hopefully we'll solve your problem. We've got a few questions now coming in, so which is nice. We've got enough for this week and next week, but keep them coming in and we'll keep posting them up and we'll roll through them as we go. We'll have a little database running. And if we get a lot of questions in, we'll expand it to 4 questions per episode perhaps. Mutter in the chat room says, ouch, $1,000 at that point, I'd go for a full DSLR or stick with the phone I've got. Which is a good point, actually. I've been shooting with the iPhone 7 last weekend out on the job, and with a low light, it wasn't perfect, but it wasn't bad. I'll give it's better than the 6 by a long way. So much, much better. First question is from Scott. Thank you for sending it in, Scott. I inherited a light meter from my late father-in-law, who was a professional photographer. I regret not having the chance to learn from him as he died shortly after his retirement. I'd like to take the next step from the P setting on my Canon SLR to full manual, but I'm never sure what aperture or shutter speed to use and how readings from a light meter affect those settings. Can you help? First thing to say is don't put too much pressure on yourself to shoot in manual. I mean, manual's useful, don't get me wrong, and once you get into the idea of shooting it and you take that leap, you'll probably spend a fair bit of time in it. Generally speaking, I would say that I spend 70% of the time in aperture priority, so that's your A mode on your top of your dial, and then I'll go into manual probably the other 30% of the time. And usually manual will end up being when I deliberately want to underexpose something. So ironically, if I shoot at night or in a tunnel, then I'm happy as Larry because I'll set one exposure and that exposure will last me the entire night. It won't be an issue. I might get a few peaks and troughs, but manual's perfect for that. If I go into the outside, I'll want to control my aperture far more in daylight because I want to control the depth of field that I get. And also then you could look at, especially if you get a cloud goes over, you can get a very, very big range of shutter speeds on that. So I want to control the aperture. I don't want the camera doing it. Do you want to move away from the P setting? Well, P is great for getting a general photograph. You know, as Missy used to say, it's the professional setting. But if you talk to most pros will tell you all that they want to control is the aperture. Once the aperture's in control, they're controlling the depth of field, they're controlling the artistic quality of the shot, and then they want the camera to work out and act like a light meter for it. So the first thing I'm going to get is letters from the purists who are going to say, oh yes, of course, but the light meter that's in the camera is a measurement of reflected light, whereas a light meter measures the direct light. True, I've got no problem with that. It's a perfectly accurate statement. But when you're talking about the camera is the thing that's recording and the camera is capturing the reflected light. It's not capturing the direct light. So in certain circumstances, you'll get some colour aberration issues if you've got the wrong exposure. And you could get, if you've got a highly reflective material, then your camera will adjust for that, whereas your light meter won't. Where's that going to be an issue? Well, okay, if you've got strong lighting and you shoot at someone who's wearing a high-vis vest or something like that, the reflective quality of that vest will perhaps affect your exposure. So if you had a direct light reading from a meter, then it wouldn't matter. But whites on whites or blacks on blacks, so if you're taking a picture of a white cup against a white background or a cream background, the reflected light doesn't separate as easily, so you'd take a direct reading from a meter then, and that would be the benefit. To be honest, I haven't used a light meter in 20 years, and I'm not sure if you put a modern one in my hands whether I'd even get the first reading out. I tend to use the camera like a light meter, and I use the LCD back. So what I spend time doing is looking at things when I get a new camera and adjusting the brightness on the LCD so it's representative of the separations between what I'm seeing with my own eye. So then when I shoot a picture, I can say, right, okay, here's what I got out of the camera on the screen, and here's what the camera sees, and I can compare the two and adjust the brightness so that it's roughly right. And then I tend to just use the camera as a light meter out on site. I'll look at a shot, I'll set it in manual, I'll take a picture where I roughly think that settings are going to be, and then if it's too dark or too light, I'll just adjust it slightly, shoot again, and then when I get back to the studio and start putting it through Photoshop, generally speaking, what I've got is accurate. So would I use a light meter now? No, I wouldn't. I'm sorry. And as I say, the purists are going to send me hate mail saying that, well, you know, you should because it's direct metering and all that kind of stuff. I think in a modern camera, there's ways around it and there's far easier stuff to do. And I think you'd probably get far more love out of keeping the light meter than necessarily running the risk of losing it, because it's got a sentimental value as well. If you want to actually learn how to use it, then really light meters are all about choosing the shutter speed. So as I said before, as a professional photographer, I would want to control the artistic elements of the image, so I want to know the aperture on it so that I can control depth of field and framing, and then I want the camera to do the rest. With a light meter, what you're going to do is put into that light meter what your aperture is and what your ISO is for your camera, and then go and take a sample of the lighting, and that will tell you your shutter speed. Okay, that's really all that it ever got used for, just purely for shutter speed, was 99% of the use, 98% of the use. I wouldn't use it, but there you go, that's me. Send your hate mail to britishnetwork@gmail.com and I'll put it in the trash. Good question. Next question is from Jason. He says, I've got a Nikon Coolpix 520 and a very limited photo experience. Are the auto settings fine for decent pictures? Also, when taken in low light and people moving, how do you stop it from blurring? Okay. Ian's put a brief answer here. He said there's nothing wrong with using the auto, but it's got its limitations, and that's entirely it. I mean, generally speaking, if you're out in challenging environments like parties or something like that, where you can't guarantee what the light's going to be or where it's metering, that kind of thing, cameras now generally on an evaluative metering process tend to do a really, really good job. So sticking on auto is no shame, especially if you haven't got the experience for it. Again, go to aperture priority and you might feel an awful lot happier. The only thing to remember whenever you're doing anything with your exposure is, and I always tell people this, when Jack came to start working for me, it was the first thing I did with him. I've got a small room in the front here that's got one window in it, and it's very, very tiny. And I took him in there and I blacked off the window completely with heavy black sheeting, and then I hung up a sheet from the ceiling with some drawing pins, and I taped up the door so there was no light coming in. And then I cut a hole in the plastic, and the image from outside shone up on the sheet. I was stood inside a camera with him. And that's all you need to do to understand how cameras work. The light travels in a straight line, so what was on the floor is now on the ceiling, and what was in the sky is now on the floor. And it goes inverse, it goes upside down, it goes through that aperture that opens up. If you open the aperture up, the picture gets brighter, but it also gets more blurred. So you're forcing more emphasis on the capture quality of the capture medium, and all I've got is a sheet, so it's crap. And that's the way it works. And then if you put a lens in front of the aperture, it changes the way that the light falls onto the capture medium. It doesn't work to actually achieve it a thumb that you can see, but that's a camera. That's how it works. So it's that reference point of aperture versus shutter versus ISO, and those are the three things that decide whether you take a picture. If you want to get more complicated than that, fine, go ahead and get more complicated than that and learn more than that. But those are the three things you've got to capture. Any image you've got to have those three things in balance, and then you'll get a good image. Plain and simple. Last one, the Olympic Parade. This is from Chris. The Olympic Parade passes past my office on Monday, and I'll be one story up with lots of people milling around in the streets. What's the best way of capturing our Olympians from above, and what kit should I use? So one of the things I always tell people when they talk about getting high up to take pictures, there's a lot of people will go at something like the Wallace Monument or the Eiffel Tower or something like that, and they'll shoot a picture and they go, well, it was great view when I was up there, but when I got the pictures back, everything looked flat. You can get too high. That's the problem. So what you always want to do is get to a height whereby you're at a different viewing angle from where you would be if you were stood up as an adult, because everyone gets that view and that's what they expect. So yours will look different because you're higher up. But at a certain point, you're going to get too high, and that's when things that you're shooting stop passing through horizontal objects. So the top of a building, the top of a postbox, the top of a shop window. When you get up to the point that you're so high up that everything stops passing through horizontal planes, then you're going to get flat images, plain and simple. Now, Chris, if you're one floor up, I think you've got a really great view, but what you're going to have to do, if you can open the window in the building that you're in, is put your camera around your neck with a strap on it so that you don't drop it, and lean yourself out the window gingerly and take some pictures when the procession is further away from you and starting to move towards you. Because then that will be when you're at that position where you're high enough up to get a different view from everyone that's down in the street. Your pictures are going to stand out differently from everyone else, and you're going to get a nice shot of them still poking through things like shop windows, street signs, that kind of stuff. I'm guessing they're going to be on a double-decker bus as well. So if they're coming down on a double-decker bus and when they get to level with your window, you're not going to be right above them. That would be an awful shot. Someone on the fourth or fifth floor is going to get a terrible picture then. Unless you get the old one where someone's looking up and that's it. But at the first floor, then you're going to have probably be on the same level with them. So again, you're going to get a good line of sight with them breaking horizons and that kind of stuff. Always worth doing. Look at the weather. In the next couple of days, it might be a bit cloudy and overcast. So watch your ISO. Don't be afraid to go up to 400 or 800 ISO, because then you're going to capture at 120th of a second or 125th of a second. That's going to limit your blurring. I wouldn't get below 100th of a second on your exposure, because then you run the risk of them waving and things like that, or them moving their heads and they'll be out of focus, unless that's the artistic effect that you're looking for, plain and simple. And generally speaking, if you're shooting outdoor stuff on something that's important and you want to make sure you capture it adequately, you would like to deliberately underexpose by a fraction, because you can always correct an underexposure that's small. If you get an overexposure, if it's small, okay, it's not too bad, but the problem is that burned out whites look unnatural, whereas filled in blacks don't look as unnatural. So always, if you've got a really important shot you want to get, make sure you generally underexpose. I deliberately underexpose nearly all my shots so that I can correct them in post afterwards. There we go, that's the questions. If you've got a question, send it to us at britishtechnetwork@gmail.com and we'll get it answered. If that's the answer you wanted, great. If it's not the answer you wanted, write in and complain and I'll have another go next week. Simple as that. I'm no guru, okay? I'm just answering the way I would answer it. I've got to say a massive, massive shout out and thank you to Ian Lewis this week, because I was working at the weekend. I didn't get an awful lot of time to sit and start working on a doc. And effectively, Ian's scripted out the whole show for me. I've just been the monkey that sat down and read it this week. So Ian, awesome, mate. Thank you so much for your efforts this week. It's been absolutely brilliant. I do appreciate it. If you'd like to follow Ian, he's at ENL Photography on Twitter, and he is easily the best landscape photographer I've ever known. I haven't known lots, but he's still the best I've ever known. And he's still better than quite a few I've seen who are published to make a living out of it. So please follow Ian and look after him. He's the reason that the photo show's back on. Most definitely this week, for sure. My name's Ewan Rankin. You can get me at Ewan Rankin on Twitter. We'll be back again next week on Thursday with a photo show. It's looking good. We might be here. And we'll have a whole pile more stories and a whole load more of your questions. And that should be good. See you next week. Thanks for listening.